For the last few weeks, we've been talking about Jesus. Good thing to talk about in church, right? Jesus. We want to kind of hopefully be there all the time, if not most of the time. But we're trying to take a fresh look at Jesus. You know, I don't know if you're like me, but sometimes I think I know Jesus, and then I'll read something in the Gospels again, and I'm like, oh, that's okay. Maybe not what I thought. And so we're looking at the Gospels to rediscover who Jesus really is, and even probably more importantly, how he engaged with the world, because that's equally important. And to be honest, none of these messages are necessarily earth-shattering. None of them are like, wow, I've never heard that before. And we're fully aware of that. But we're also fully aware that there's moments where we need to be reminded and refreshed on who Jesus really is. Because I know maybe you're like me. These are my moments of confession. Amy wanted confession this morning, so here you go. I find these messages that we've been in to be a bit challenging. I want an easy Jesus. I want a Jesus basically that leaves me alone. I want a Jesus that doesn't really make too many demands on my life. I want to live my nice, happy, middle-class, suburban existence. And come to church on Sunday, and Jesus, you just look at me and say, good job, Brent, just keep doing what you're doing. That's the Jesus I want. That is a different Jesus. And what I'm finding is, as I dig even again into the Gospels, is there is a difference between the Jesus I see here and the Jesus that I may be trying to live out. The temptation for me is to try to make a Jesus that looks like me, that talks like me, that acts like me, that and just blesses everything about my life without making any challenges or any claims on me. And this desire to create Jesus in our own image is coupled with this incredibly strong cultural wind and this incredibly strong, these strong cultural forces all around us that kind of make this mosaic Jesus. Well, this is what he looks like. That's what they tell us. And everyone says, and the thing you need to know is Jesus is on my side. I mean, we hear that a lot, don't we? Jesus is on my side. And whatever side that may be. And so it's, you know, I don't know, but if I'm sometimes inside the church, I'm a pastor, and sometimes I'm a bit confused. And I can only imagine what those that may be not in the church, but outside the church, those that don't really know Jesus, can you imagine the level of confusion that they have over this image of Jesus that just, you know, it's confusing, it's honestly exhausting. And I don't know, occasionally even I feel like just throw my hands up in the air and just give up. But then I do turn back to the Gospels. And I see the stories, and I read about this incredibly beautiful and complicated person, fully God, fully human, who is loving, who is the most compassionate person that we've ever seen. He stands up for people. He stands up against injustice. He knocks down religiosity. And he's even humble as he does it. We read about him in Philippians where it says, he made himself nothing by taking the very nature of a servant being made in human likeness. If we're not careful, Jesus can seem almost too good to be true, can't he? But he's very true. He's very real. And with the real Jesus, as you've heard every week, comes a beautiful and wonderful invitation to me and to you. And he says this, he says, come follow me. And when he says, come follow me, it's not just follow me, it's come and see what I do and hear what I say, and then let's sit down together and sit at my feet and apprentice under me. Be my disciples, learn from me so that you can now be a little Jesus in your world. You know, and so far, we've been looking at a lot of the internals of Jesus. We've talked about his compassion. That's something driven from inside. We've talked about, you know, his caring for people. We talked about his generosity and how he calls us to this non-idolatry of money. Amy talked last week about his humility and knowing who you are and still being able to serve others because you have nothing to prove. But today I want to turn our attention to something, how these characteristics manifest themselves in our daily lives. Because it's easy to say, I'm compassionate, until we come face to face with somebody that may challenge our compassion. Or maybe somebody, we can say, I'm very generous, until we get to a place where we come face to face with somebody that challenges our generosity, because instead of just being generous, we want to judge and we want to say, well, why do you need? What have you done? Or maybe it's come to that humility point where we see power slipping from our hands, control being taken from us, and our first reaction is, oh no, you can't have it, it's mine. And our humility is called into question, or we're actually putting it out there to see, are we truly as compassionate and humble and generous as Jesus? Now, warning here, I'm going to put some pictures on the screen that may make you a little uncomfortable. Good. So what happens when you come face to face with this? Can you still look like Jesus when facing that? Will we still show love, compassion, generosity, and humility with this next picture? I just like to let it sit for a second. Makes you uncomfortable, right? Can you reflect Jesus to somebody like this? Or what about this? And who can not turn on the news lately and be confronted with this? Anyone else get a little nervous or uncomfortable with one or more of those pictures? Good. We need to be a little uncomfortable, don't we? You're in good company because Jesus' disciples were also a lot uncomfortable about many of the things he said and did, as were the religious leaders. You see, when we begin to see the real Jesus, it really should make us squirm a little bit. It should make us a little uncomfortable. Because when you begin to really look at who Jesus was, what he did, and who he hung out with, we really begin to get a deeper insight into maybe who he is and what he came to do. His message to those he hung out with, to those in the pictures that we saw, was a message of God's love. And I think it's a challenge for us to ask ourselves, would we be hanging out with the same type of people that Jesus hung out with? Are we reaching out to the same type of people that Jesus did? Or are we not even open to engaging them in conversation as Jesus often did? I mean, we've already looked at how Jesus treated them with generosity and compassion and humility, but today I want to look specifically at the who. Who did Jesus engage with? And let's figure out, why did Jesus affiliate so much with the outcast? I mean, it would have been easier and probably a lot less dangerous for Jesus if he had simply gone to West Des Moines, Iowa, and bought him a house in a nice little suburban neighborhood and got him a nice little job and just kept his house nose down, you know, and just maybe if he wanted to effect some change, just meet with those in charge and say, hey guys, I've got some ideas, you know. Meet with those with status, you know, the upper middle class of his day. If he hung out with them, taught them, if that's where he had started, maybe that would have saved him some trouble. But we don't see Jesus doing that. Sure, he did have dinner at the home of Pharisees at times. Sure, he was hung out with religious leaders. He was in the temple. He was in the synagogues. He was in the places of power occasionally. But Jesus was incredible at being able to run in different circles at different times. And from what we can tell, even though he was in that circle some, a lot of his time was spent with the undesirables. His teaching seemed to be directed at them. And where do we start with that? We start with the poor. Let's look at a few passages. Jesus began his ministry. I love the story. I think we're going to see this again in the series, but Jesus was in a synagogue and he gets the scroll and it's his day to teach and he sits down and he quotes from Isaiah in this passage in Luke. It says, "And the Spirit of the Lord is on me because he has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor." I don't know if you know this or not, but probably 99% of us, that leaves out. What does that mean? Interesting, isn't it? Or a bit later when Jesus said this in Luke 6, he says, looking at his disciples, he said, "Blessed are you who are poor, for yours is the kingdom of God." I hope Jesus doesn't just stay here because that may leave some of us out. Or even this beautiful story where he was at the temple, watching the temple treasury one day, and he sits down opposite the disciples where the offerings were being put in, and he watched the crowd putting in their money. It says, "Many rich people threw in large amounts, but a poor widow came and put in two small copper coins worth only a few cents." And he looked at his disciples and he says, "I tell you, this poor widow has put in more into the treasury than all the others. They all gave out of their wealth, but she gave out of her poverty, put in everything, all she had to live on." What is Jesus doing here? Jesus is taking those that are on the outside and he's saying, "You get to come in." I mean, remember, we've talked about this before. In this time, in this place, wealth was seen as God's blessings upon you. If you had money, it meant you were living right and God was smiling upon you. And the inverse was also true, that if you were poor, it's because you were either a worthless sinner or you have done something to anger God and he has made you poor to get back at you until you repent and turn your life around. And what is Jesus doing here? Jesus is doing just the opposite, isn't he? What Jesus is doing is he's humanizing the poor. And he showed them that God had not forgotten them, that God had not neglected them. In fact, just the opposite, that God was inviting them and receiving them. If your whole existence existed around, "I have nothing because God is mad at me," how do you think this message would hit home? Be powerful, wouldn't it? Be powerful. I'll follow you wherever you go. What a powerful message from Jesus. That's not all he did, though. That's not the only group that he came for. Look at this. Look at the children. We love children, right? We ought to. I have to. I have seven there. I love them all. But in a day and age back then, when children were of no importance, subject to the authority of their elders, they really weren't taken as seriously except as a responsibility, one to be looked after, not one to be looked up to, Jesus takes this other class and says, "You're looking at them all wrong." Look at what he says here in Matthew chapter 19. It says, "Then people brought little children to Jesus for him to place his hands on them and pray for them, but the disciples rebuked them. Jesus said, 'Let the little children come to me. Do not hinder them, for the kingdom of heaven belongs to such as these.'" I mean, I don't think we fully get the impact and power of that statement. The kingdom of heaven belongs to such as these. We have this mentality that would say, no. The kingdom of heaven belongs to such as me. And Jesus, just in these first two groups, is saying, you need to pause for a moment. Look at who I'm bringing in. Look who I'm here for. I mean, there was another exchange that Jesus had in Matthew 18. Look at this. It says, "At the time the disciples came to Jesus and asked, 'Who then is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?' Amy talked about this last week. He called a little child to him and placed the child among them. He said, 'Truly I tell you, unless you change and become like little children, you'll never enter the kingdom of heaven.'" What? These little grubby things are dirty and they're smelly and they're difficult and they have fits. And they don't go to bed when you tell them to, and they eat my food, and they cost me money, and I have to take them to the doctor. What do you mean that the kingdom of heaven belongs to such as these, and unless I become like a child? So what Jesus did here? Isn't it beautiful what Jesus did here? What is he telling the disciples? The ones that you dismiss, the ones that you say don't matter, matter a lot. Yes. Matter more than you can possibly imagine. And Jesus doesn't, he said, you know, I don't care. He's saying, I don't care if they say the right things. I don't care if they sit up straight. I don't care if they're dirty or smelly. I'm welcoming them. And you need to take a lesson from them. I mean, even that right there is kind of challenging, right? I mean, to take the outcast, the fringes of society, and Jesus saying, you see that? You could take a lesson. Oh, I don't think so, Jesus. Who are you talking to? They don't have it together like I do. Now, we would never say these things out loud, would we? But they might be things we think. And in our moments of complete honesty, yeah, it might be more accurate. Jesus welcomes the children, and he says, our culture may not see your value, but in my kingdom, you are welcome. I will say, just side note here in parentheses, it says, we may have let this pendulum swing a little too far with letting kids control everything, but that's a different message for a different time. We need to find a good, happy middle here, right? What about the unclean? We mentioned that a couple weeks ago in the compassion message. Lepers that Jesus touched, who had failed to have human touch in a long time. The adulterous woman that was caught in the act, the woman at the well. But also, not just those who society said were unclean, what about those who were unclean by their own doing? Have you thought about that? Those who were unclean by their own choices. Those who would have made choices who would put them on the outs with society, like prostitutes, like tax collectors in the day. Not only did Jesus welcome them, he did the most scandalous thing you could possibly do with these individuals. He ate with them. Look at this. It says, while Jesus was having dinner at Matthew's house, many tax collectors and sinners came and ate with him and his disciples. When the Pharisees saw this, they asked his disciples, why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners? One of my favorite stories is Jesus having dinner at the home of a Pharisee. And this woman of ill repute, everybody knew her reputation. And she walks right in. She sits right down at Jesus' feet, and she anoints his feet with her tears and expensive perfume. Just look at the story. It says when Jesus was at the home of a Pharisee, they had dinner. A woman in town who lived a sinful life learned that he was there. She brought this jar of perfume. She stood behind him at his feet weeping. She began to wet his feet with her tears. She wiped them with her hair. She kissed them, and she poured perfume on them. And the Pharisee who had invited him saw as he said, if this man were a prophet, he would know who is touching him and what kind of woman she is. She's a sinner. And Jesus said, I have something to tell you. He says, two people owed money to a moneylender, one 500 denarii and the other 50. Neither had the money. He forgave both debts. Which of them will love him more? Well, I suppose the one who'd had the bigger debt forgiven. Jesus said, you're right. And look at this. Then he turned to the woman and he said to Simon, do you see this woman? I came into your house and you did not give me any water for my feet, but she wet my feet with her tears and wiped them with her hair. You did not give me a kiss, but this woman from the time I entered has not stopped kissing my feet. You did not put oil on my head, but she has poured perfume on my feet. I tell you, her many sins have been forgiven as her great love has shown. I mean, just think, put yourself in that moment. A good prophet, a godly prophet, would have said, don't touch me and make me unclean, you whore. Get out. That was the expectation, wasn't it? I mean, that's why the criticism comes. And once again, Jesus just amazes us, doesn't he? What's he do? He uses it as an opportunity to kind of critique the religious of the day. Well, you didn't wash my feet. You didn't anoint my head. You didn't kiss me as the typical greeting would be when I came in. And here she is. And what's he do? Your sins are forgiven. What? Jesus once again just amazes us with what he does. I mean, let's just think for a moment. Who among us would have had this response? Who among us represents that Jesus? I mean, not only just welcoming, teaching, Jesus called a tax collector to be one of his 12 disciples. We would never even have looked at that person to be on church staff, more or less a disciple of Jesus. We wouldn't let them be the custodian of the church because of their sin. Amazing, isn't it? What about another group? About people Jesus elevated. Can we talk about the women? Said a woman. No. Men usually wouldn't speak to women. Why would they? Women existed for the use of men. You are my property. You're to be used for whatever I want. When I get tired of you, I can get rid of you. It's all up to my discretion. Great time to be a man. But like the woman in the previous story, Jesus not just elevated them, he acknowledged them, he spoke to them. There's a story where a woman has an issue where she's been bleeding for years, and Jesus heals her. She touches the hem of his garment. And look at what he says to her, Luke 8:48. He calls her a daughter of Abraham. I mean, can we just talk about what it means to say the words daughter to someone? No longer outcast, elevated. And we cannot ignore the fact that the very first people that heralded the message of the resurrection were who?
Women.
Women. Guys were still hiding and afraid. The women were the ones who were given the message. They went to the tomb. They were met with the angels, told he's not here, told he is risen, and were given the message. Now go tell others. I mean, would we even know Jesus had risen if it wasn't for the women? Probably not. Thank you, women. In a day and age where the testimony of women wasn't even allowable in court, you know, because women can be a little emotional, a little hysterical. I mean, not like guys. We'd never do such a thing. In that, you know. But Jesus deliberately and intentionally appeared to women. And when you look at him, he constantly elevated them. In fact, his whole ministry, we're told, was supported primarily by women, the money of women. There's one more group we need to look at too, though. There's several, right? Aren't you amazed? I mean, looking at this, all these stories, there's story after story of Jesus going to who culture would call unimportant and outcast. But there's one more group, and that was the Gentiles. He crossed these racial and ethnic barriers, not just with the Gentiles, but with the Samaritans. He brought them the good news. He healed that centurion soldier's servant. And there was this moment where this Canaanite woman comes to him and she says, hey, my daughter is demon-possessed. Can you help her? She's a Gentile, a non-Jewish person. Just look at this interesting exchange with Jesus that she has. It says, a Canaanite woman from the vicinity comes to him crying out, Lord, son of David, have mercy on me. My daughter is demon-possessed and suffering terribly. Jesus did not answer a word. So his disciples came to him and urged him, send her away. She keeps crying after us. He answered to her, I was sent only to the lost sheep of Israel. She comes and kneels before him and says, Lord, help me. And he replies, it's not right to take the children's bread and toss it to the dogs. Dog being a common expression that Jews would use to talk about Gentiles. Yes, it is, Lord, she said. Even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from the master's table. Then Jesus said to her, woman, you have great faith. Your request is granted. And her daughter was healed at that moment. Strange, isn't it? Weird. Why did Jesus call her a dog? Why did Jesus say that? Was he actually meaning it? I don't think so. He was trying to make a point. Think about the disciples. They're like, shoo, go away. I was reading one commentary and it said this. It says, the written words cannot convey a twinkle in the eye. I thought that was interesting. One other commentary said, the tone and the look with which a thing is said can make all the difference. Even a thing which seems hard can be said with a disarming smile. We can call an old friend a rascal or a villain with a smile and a tone which takes all the sting out of it and fills it with affection. we can be quite sure that the smile on Jesus' face and the compassion in his eyes robbed the words of all insult and bitterness. Was he calling her a dog? Nope. He was teaching his disciples a lesson. And what was that lesson? The lesson is this, that those that the world may say have no value are exactly the ones that he came to save. And to best illustrate this, Jesus told a parable. It's found in Luke chapter 14. Again, he's having dinner with a Pharisee. And they're trying to jockey for a position. They want to know who's going to be the greatest and all this. And he tells this parable. He says, a certain man was preparing a great banquet and invited many guests. At the time of the banquet, he sent his servant to tell those who had been invited, come, for everything is now ready. So back then, here's how it worked. I'm planning a party. I send you an invitation. I say, I'm going to have a party. Can you come? And you RSVP right then. Yes, I'm coming. Great. I'll tell you when it's ready. I'm making the preparations, when the party's ready, I send out my guest and they tell you it's ready and you come back. And that's when you come. So he says, come, for everything's now ready. But they all alike began to make excuses. The first said, I've just bought a field and I must go and see it. Lame excuse. Who buys a field without seeing it? Please excuse me. Another said, I've just bought my 5 yoke of oxen and I'm on my way to try them out. No, you're not. Nobody buys oxen without trying them out first. Please excuse me. Another said, I just got married, so I can't come. Yes, you could claim marriage as an excuse to get out of military service, but not usually social invitations. The servant came back and reported to his master. Then the owner of the house became angry and ordered his servant, go out quickly into the streets and alleys of the town and bring in the poor, the crippled, the blind, and the lame. Sir, the servant said, what have you ordered has been done, but there is still room. The master told his servant, go out to the roads and the country lanes and compel them to come in so that my house will be full. I tell you, no, not one of those who were invited will get a taste of my banquet. What's happening here? Powerful story, a reminder of Jesus to tell us the invitation is there. Those who thought they were going to have a seat might not, but this whole thing is about his kingdom, and it's about who's showing up. The original invitees, the Jewish people, obviously not all of them rejected or not all of them are out. But the religious leaders rejected Jesus, and they, when it came time to see who he was, they're like, no, we're not interested. And Jesus is saying, that's right. There's going to be people invited that just say, nope, not interested. And then that means we're going to continue to expand. And we're going to go to the outcast of our culture and society and bring them in. And guess what? That won't be enough because there's still going to be room. And we're going to go even further. We're going to cross all the lines to extend this invitation far and wide so everybody we know has the possibility to hear about the love of Jesus. The ultimate point of this is who's going to be sitting at the table. God's going to invite all kinds of people, including those usually left out. We're called to live out this kingdom principle even today. But we have to ask the question, how we live, is it creating barriers, preventing others to come to know Jesus, or are we removing those barriers? Where God is working, and who is responding to him might not be where we think it is or with who we think it should be. We're probably going to be surprised, like the people around Jesus were, about who was going to be at that great banquet. And if people miss the banquet, it's not because of a lack of opportunity. God offers that invitation to all, but still some miss it. He doesn't force anyone to come. Reading this week in my studies, and I ran across a pastor who talked about the outcast that Jesus came to. And I thought this was just well said, so I thought I'd just put it out here. He said, you know who Jesus welcomed his family? Jesus loved the easiest people to hate. You think about that? He loved the easiest people to hate. The tax collectors, the sinners. Do we do this? Do we love the easiest people to hate, or as our cultural forces push us, do we see it as an opportunity to just pile on, to create an enemy, to start blasting them in conversation, to wail on them on social media? Before you do that, we probably need to stop. And remember, Jesus loved the easiest people to hate. Another category was simply this: Jesus showed respect to the disrespected. It was a touch, a kind word, eye contact, talking, taking someone who had been kicked by life repeatedly and reminding them that they were made in the image of God, that you matter to me and you matter to Jesus. Jesus was constantly reinstilling respect. And then the last category this pastor mentioned was just simply this: Jesus blessed those who could offer him nothing in return. That's where the kids would fit, the women would fit. And what does that show us? Jesus is not a transactional savior. You see, the easiest thing for us to do is to judge a book by its cover, or to judge a person by their hair, by their clothes, by their tattoos, by their job, by their car. You see, Jesus saw people for who they were, but also for who they could be in him. And he constantly called people to that possibility. He reminded them that they were not who they were at their worst moments. And he came to give his life for them. And he tells them, and he tells us, you were worth dying for. Why does this seem so difficult today? Why is it easier and often celebrated to demonize others rather than love? Why does it feel like our status is threatened when we try to raise up other people? We don't have to push others down to be built up. Defeating others only makes us all losers. Subjugating others doesn't elevate us. It subjugates all of us. And we've got to realize this. There's a strong cultural push to other people to say it's all about me and people who look like me and act like me, and those are the ones that are in. And Jesus said, you're wrong. You're wrong. It's not about you and all the people that look and talk and live like you. I came for much more than that. And so what do? We do a couple of things here. One of the things when we're countering this or we're facing this is, I think one of the things we do is, well, it makes me uncomfortable, so I'm just going to isolate. I'm going to set myself apart. I'm not going to engage. And you know the problem with that is that isolation does a few things to us. It creates greater divides. It makes us suspicious. It reinforces stereotypes, and it moves us to behave in awful, terrible ways that we never would before with such spite. If we don't move to isolation, we move to tribalism, which we just surround ourselves with people like us. And that's not the answer either, because you know what it does? It puffs us up with pride. It creates enemies out of others. It justifies prejudice and builds wall. It builds the entire walls that Jesus came to tear down. I read this question this week, and I thought it would be a good way to end. Who does the world hate that Christ has called us to love? You see, Jesus was about the outcast. Spent a lot of time there. Why? Because those are the people who feel like Jesus has nothing to do with them. Those are the ones that feel like Jesus could never love me. And they need us to step alongside and just show them and demonstrate the love of Jesus. Are we willing to be seen with them, eat meals with them, call them our friends, or do we care more about others, what others might think about us? Well, what if they see us together? I mean, I might have to sacrifice a little bit of my dignity to be like Jesus. We wouldn't say that out loud either, but I wonder if sometimes we think that. Are we pursuing the same people that Jesus pursued? Are we demonstrating to them, you are made in the image of God, and Jesus died just as much for you as he did for me? Who does this world hate that Jesus has called us to love? Let's pray. Father, thank you. Maybe not thank you. This is a challenging message, Lord, and I don't like it. I want to sit in my nice, comfortable suburban house, and I don't want to be faced with stepping out. But Jesus, you demonstrated a love that just is almost incomprehensible to me, a willingness to cross barriers that I don't know that I'm willing to cross all the time. But I know if I want to be like you, if I want to sit at your feet, you're going to call me, you're going to move me into these places, God, of uncomfortableness. You're going to ask me to step out of my comfort zone and into a world that looks very different than what I'm used to. You're going to call me to be the hands and the feet of Jesus to the most despised, the most rejected. And I'm going to be tempted to say, well, you're there because it's your fault. And I never see Jesus saying that. I see him encountering people who, when they see him, they know who they are. And in that moment, he's able to say, your sins are forgiven. Now go and sin no more. God, can you help me to have that heart? Can you help me to not get sucked into a tribalism or an isolation that separates me from others, that God, you compel me to go forward and to demonstrate that love? Jesus, you're challenging me today, challenging me a lot. Thank you.